And I'd like to open the floor up for discussion. Okay, Pierre wants to go. So, but we had three very different things. One was a genetic theory approach in the beginning. The second one was an approach where you actually take into account particle static forces. And the third one was something in between. So, I mean, everyone has their own opinion of what should work and what shouldn't. But the hope is that at the end we'll have some, we'll understand each other a little better. So.
I would like to come on the simulation of Stefan, because I was not understanding why you get friction when you don't put friction in your experiment in 2D. You see, you put a cohesion and you don't, you tell you don't put friction. As a matter of fact, I believe now that you put friction, because the way you put it is to put a force which goes to a given value, then it decreases, come back, and goes to zero, so you get a cycle like that, and the energy of the dissipation here is directly proportional to the force. So it means that you directly induce the friction coefficient. By this, yeah, exactly. Okay.
I want to address Pierre's question. The angle of internal friction, the internal friction has two contributions. One from the direct frictional interaction of the particles, and the other is from the dense packing. So that in a very dense array of spheres, let's say, the normal interactions can provide a tangential resistance. So I think that's the simple explanation of what Stefan is seeing in the limit of zero friction.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Sorry, but if you have only cohesion, you know the at the end, at large deformation, you have no more variation of volume. And then in this case, you should not have a friction coefficient. It should be independent of the pressure. But the way the cohesion has been implemented is equivalent to put a friction coefficient, because the law is the following. You get F goes like that, you get to F max then, and then you come back. So you have a cycle here which dissipates energy. And this dissipation is directly proportional to the maximum force. So it means by each contact, when the contact breaks, you get always the same an energy which is directly proportional to the force, so it's equivalent to a friction coefficient.
That's normal.
Yeah, but that's what he did, no? What I mean here is the dissipation which is proportional to the force. And the cohesion is not, the dissipation of a cohesion should not be proportional to the force.
I thought the issue was the fact that there was a tangential force in the absence of friction.
But here, each time you change the contact, you break a contact, then you dissipate. And that's the way it inputs the friction, because it's
a oh.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd just like to make a comment about this issue of kinetic theory for dense flows. I've gotten very confused about this issue, I have to confess, because kinetic theory is not, there's not the kinetic theory of dense flows or for chute flows that one can compare with. Kinetic theory is an entire approach which in some forms can include very sophisticated inclusion of correlations arising in a flow. So I would like to rephrase the what I think the issues are in a way that the many speakers who are going to be discussing dense flows in the course of this week will perhaps be able to say what they agree with and what they disagree with in a way that maybe sharpens the debate a little bit. I think that there are a couple of fundamental things about the theory that Denise presented and the way the numerical results are interpreted, which you know may or may not be recoverable by you know other computational means. One is that in the core of a chute flow, there is a region with fundamentally constant density, a density which does not depend upon the depth of the flow. And this comes out not directly, but is a natural consequence of the kind of scaling length-based approach that Denise was talking about. The second key feature is the existence of the Poulikin flow rule, which not only has the overall Bagnold scaling, which many theories are going to be able to reproduce for obvious dimensional reasons, but also does something else. It links the rheology in the flow to the length scale that's determined by the phase boundary of the flow. And there are some kinetic theories in the literature which are not able to do that. There may be others which can. I think that beyond that, it becomes a kind of philosophical question as to whether one finds it prefers theories that are built around scaling lengths, such as the theory that Denise was speaking of, or whether one prefers instead theories that are built around the two-particle distribution function, which is the object that is most natural in kinetic theory approaches. And that is a very interesting and important philosophical debate. In the ideal world, one would be able to get adequate phenomenological approaches from both theories. But I think the fundamental issue is, do you have a constant density in your theory? And two, do you have a Poulikin flow rule? Or do you believe that one or the other of those is in fact wrong and we have been fooled by the way we have been interpreting the numerical and experimental data?
Before Michelle goes, let me just add that there's kinetic theories as they are framed for particles without a friction coefficient predict that the flow rule is determined by an energy balance, because you need to generate enough energy by the shear for it to be dissipated by the particles, and that's where you get the minimum angle of inclination from, whereas the correlation lengths tend to predict it is due to momentum balance. Okay, so that's another fundamental difference. And I think the third thing that is sort of crucial here is the fact that the inverse of the strain rate is the only time scale in the problem. I mean, that is something that I wouldn't have expected a priori. So that is the third crucial aspect. I shouldn't misuse my position as session chair, but the other thing is that the Poulikin flow rule actually increases much sharper than the simulations. Okay, it starts to diverge at about 5 to 10 particle diameters. The simulations don't, and that sort of puzzled me a lot. But perhaps there's others who have better ideas on that. But Michelle is going to talk to us, give a talk in the next session, but he's got lots to say. So.
Thank you very much. I agree generally in the way to frame the problem that Tom just mentioned. I would like to say something about the Poulikin flow rule, and Kumar just alluded to it. The Poulikin flow rule is a convenient way to frame the problem. but it really compares apples and oranges fundamentally, because H stop is a quantity that arises from a flow which is fundamentally different than a flow that exhibits a wide core. In other words, the what I called basal flows are flows where there's no core. And those flows are governed by, very much influenced by the boundary. In fact, they're essentially boundary layers and nothing but. Whereas a shoot flow with a core that exhibits the Bagnold scaling is in fact dominated by the core as long as the core is thick enough. And the core itself, as Namiko Mitarai, for instance, and others have showed, is not influenced by the boundaries, neither the top or the bottom boundary. They're dominated by it. Most of the mass flow, it comes from the core. So these two flows, basal flows and flows that exhibit large core, are completely fundamentally different. And it is a total coincidence, a happy one perhaps, that Olivier Pouliquen was able to recast his flow in such a way. But it's important to distinguish the two flows. In fact, if I find the time later, I could show you that he could not do experiments. He had no experiments between his H stop in the phase diagram and the core, the flows that exhibit both the surface layer and the core. And that I think is a smoking gun to indicate that it was completely a coincidence. But it's a happy one.
I would add that the same thing. Simulations have shown that the bottom boundary layer conditions don't really affect the flow of the core. Current simulations have shown.
I have two remarks about the concept of core flows. The first one is, experimentally, for a dry flow, what is the maximum thickness possible. Actually, there is a strong contrast between simulation data and experimental data. It appeared to be impossible to observe a thick flow experimentally. So it is essential to explain this mismatch. Olivier Pouliquen, as mentioned by Michel Louge, the fast diagram obtained by Olivier Pouliquen showing the motionless state, stationary flow, and accelerated flow was extracting from data up to 15 grain size thickness. Why 15 or 20? Because it was impossible to create a thicker flow. If we increases the supply influx, what is observed experimentally is that there is formation of a at-rest substrate lying on the lower boundary, and this motionless substrate the boundary between this motionless substrate made of grains and the flowing layers as displays a slope larger than the channel slope. So there is a reason for which, and we have to explain what, it is difficult to observe large thickness flow. The second thing I would like to mention is concerns the core flow. Apparently, from simulations, core flows exhibit Bagnold-like behavior. And personally, I am questioned by this behavior, because you know that for dense flow, the large cluster, there is a real question to address concerning the restitution coefficient of large clusters. You know that if you drop down a bag full of grains, there is no bounce at all. It means that for large clusters, the effective restitution coefficient is zero, so that the kinetic theories would fail in that case of zero restitution coefficient, because kinetic theory mainly are expansion of classical elastic spheres, hard sphere theory from at the vicinity of E restitution coefficient close to one. So there is a real problem with the meaning of this about the application of kinetic theory for core flows. I think that this is the procedure of the simulation itself. You prepare at rest a large thickness layer, and you input gravity. But you know, as showed by Stefan Luding, mainly a shear process is encountered also in a biaxial compressive test. And in that case, you have just to rotate the eigenaxis of 45 degrees. And in that case, it is known that the formation of a shear band of typically 15 or 20 grain size. Oh, yes. The problem is that the formation of typically a shear band of low, small thickness upper layer flowing down is an instability. And the formation of a shear band is an instability, and are the simulation sensitive to the instability? This is just a way, I don't know. Yes.
Similar, they didn't have the sophistication.
It was a two-dimensional study, and they didn't have the sophistication about the forces that Stefan was talking about. But they did look precisely at this issue of shear banding, and they're in the regime where the shear rate is very low. In fact, in the regime where the shear rate, basically the inertia number, the shear rate divided by the square root of pressure is low, they did see shear banding. However, the flows in the regime where that parameter is a little bit larger, which corresponds, in fact, precisely to the accessible regime for core flow in the simulations or in the experiment, they did not see a flow that was unstable, dominated by shear banding. So, you know, of course, you always worry with simulations that the boundary conditions in some way could be preventing the appearance of shear bands. However, there is some evidence that in the range of shear rates that are accessible in these simulations, shear banding is not the dominant phenomenon.
Yeah.
I mean, we should ask Leo. I mean, I don't think we were a billion times too small. Too small.
Well, but yeah, so perhaps we should. Yeah, we can discuss it later. Yeah. Michelle, you have...
I have a comment regarding Michelle's statement and regarding the difference in basal flows and core flows. If one still thinks of a progression of measurements where you basically start from H-stop, which is you call as a basal flow, and you know, slowly increasing, clearly... it's, you know, there's a maximum thickness of a basal flow that's basically still after which point you basically go to this core flow as you increase this height. So, I mean, even if you say that the boundary layer is controlled by different parameters than the core flow, the fact that the length scale that controls those thicknesses are the same could simply be a result of the fact that, you know, you have to satisfy certain boundary conditions and only at certain thicknesses do you achieve this. So I mean, even if the flows are different, that doesn't necessarily mean that what you see in the core flow indicates what you would expect to see in the basal flow, because it's just basically, you know, in turbulence, a wall layer depends very different from your, you know, from your defect layer, but yet still, you know, they are connected by the fact that, you know, they cross one, crosses over to the other one. So, I mean, I wouldn't use that as an argument to discount the fact that, you know, it's just, I don't think it's just a coincidence that one gives, you know, one length scale, it happens to be the same as the other one. I tend to think there's a more, a deeper reason for why they're related, I guess.
Address that, hopefully. We should go on to the other topic, which was segregation, and, the thing that sort of came out was that there is a difference between theory and experiments. So the question that one can ask is, what do the theoreticians want the experimentalists to measure, or what do the experimentalists want the theoreticians to write down? So is either the experimentalist or the theoretician up to the challenge?
I shouldn't say what the experimentalists want. In steady states with gradients in them, in temperature, density, could you write down profiles as a function of stoichiometric parameters and as a function of particle ratios? If so, there's data that's available. So the parameters in the experiment are all measured, or in most experiments are all known.
You know, as I said, I think we have theory that we have confidence in certain regions of parameter space, and that has to do with situations in which not too much energy is dissipated in the interactions between particles, and where the particle properties don't differ by extreme amounts. That is, they're not so great a difference in size and not so great a difference in mass. But in those situations, we can solve your boundary value problems. I mean, the difficulty is their boundary value problems, and that's why I was emphasizing this algebraic characterization, is because I don't have to solve a boundary value problem in order to say whether segregation is going to occur or not. But yes, I mean, as long as you're in the region of parameter space that we're comfortable in, we can solve your boundary value problems, or we can give you the MATLAB programs that we use to solve them.
No, but I mean, you sort of calculating the coefficient assuming some kind of a Maxwell distribution, and that's going to change things by order one, coefficient, if it's not truly a Maxwell distribution.
Well, I think you ought to try. You ought to try with the predictions that we have and see how they fail, if they fail.
I mean, a clearer test would be actually to calculate the velocity distribution and see how they
fail. Well, you can do that. I mean, you can do that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but you need to identify a set of a minimal set of mechanisms that are leading to these things, because you have obviously many things that are going on. Right? For one thing, the bigger particles are more massive, so they're going to settle because of that. Okay. You have temperature gradients, you have the vacancy migration effect in these systems. Yeah. Mm. Right. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
There was some discussion earlier, I think was brought up about the simulations, and I was just wondering maybe if Stefan could comment on whether this issue of whether you actually give a temperature to the grains or there's some gradient set up in the comparison from driving it from a boundary.
Demonic driving, so or democratic driving or non-democratic driving, and still I got frustrated because, yeah, the mean field type theory which Tim showed implies, if I understand it right, that you have the same type of driving which can be described by the S for all particles in the system independent of all the density of all the other parameters. And that is the big problem, because the S is not constant. It's not independent of the distance from the wall, it's not independent of the density, not independent of other parameters, and also not independent of the species. And this is the big challenge, to formulate a reference, to find a reference experiment which we can describe by kinetic theory, or even I would be happy with a simulation which can be specified such that it has a driving which can be formulated in a nice way in kinetic theory. And I had some discussion with Isaac Goldhirsch, and he found astonishing agreement for a driven system with the simulations and the theory, for even some weak friction in the system in kinetic theory approach. So, and he seems to have a formulation for one type of driving. I use another type of driving, and I don't understand that. I cannot describe kinetic theory for that. Or for the democratic driving, I see a chance, because there we also had results, also concerning the velocity distributions. But that is far from realistic, unfortunately. Because I realized at some point that the outgoing particles have a different temperature than the incoming particles. I cannot.
No, but. But you're trying it deterministically in a realistic.
Oh, he's talking about MD simulations.
I can make a general comment about the thermal wall. It's one of the ways of heating the system in a controlled way. so that any particle that hits the wall, for example, forgets completely about its initial its velocity and picks up a new velocity from a Gaussian ensemble. People have been frustrated for a few years by the fact that the particles that are incoming into the system are on the average hotter than the particles are hitting the wall. It's simply because there is a temperature gradient near the wall. The temperature is highest at the wall, and then it goes down because of the bulk collisions. Now, this process is not exclusive to inelastic gases. Just take elastically colliding spheres or disks, and put them into a system with two walls kept at a different temperature. You will have a temperature gradient in the system, and as a result, you will have this effect near each of the two walls. And it is known how to take it into account, even analytically, if the mean free path near the wall is much smaller than the typical scale of the temperature gradient.
I realize we want coffee, so I'll try to keep this short. I would distinguish temperature gradients from the way energy is input into the system. I don't think going from what Jim was talking about to a real experiment, let's say agitated at a wall or something, simply requires looking at a system with small temperature gradients. I think even if you look in a region with zero gradients, if you're driving the system from a boundary, you're going to get very different results.
So I'll give the last word to our first speaker.
Ricky Wildman and John Huntley are having success in implementing boundary conditions for a vibrated boundary in experiments that they're undertaking. So I think we have two boundaries that I feel we have confidence in. One is a vibrated, let's say, flat boundary. And the other is a bumpy boundary in a shearing flow. Both have been used in the context of the kinetic theory, and have been, and the predictions have been tested against numerical simulation and physical experiments. So, in my view, we've got a couple of boundaries that the kinetic theory is comfortable in employing, and that have had some success in practice.
The only thing I would add is that's the reason why shear flow is so clean, because if it's a homogeneous shear, then you don't have to worry about properties as the energy source. So I'd like to thank all our speakers once again for this. And we start again at 11:15. Okay.